This is a Charles Russell Speechleys podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Property Patter. Today we are looking at agricultural tenancies. My name is Emma Humphreys and I have two of my colleagues from Charles Russell Speechleys here with me. James Green is a transactional real estate lawyer and Emma Priest deals with real estate disputes. We're also joined by Rebecca Catamol of Tamfield Chambers. Welcome, Rebecca. In terms of why we're talking about this topic, I am sure all of our listeners are aware of the continuing political and economic pressures around housing, with supply consistently falling short of demand. The Conservative Party's 2019 manifesto made a clear commitment to promote house building, including pledging to simplify the planning process. However, those landowners who are assessing the development potential of their land need to consider the impact which any existing agricultural tenancies might have on the process. Before we look at the potential issues which can arise from these agricultural tenancies, James, perhaps you could tell me about how the market is moving in this area, including economic pressures generally for landowners.
Sure. Well, as you said in your introduction, Emma, what we've seen over the past 10, 20 years is housing supply falling short of the targets that successive governments have set, and that position hasn't really changed. In its last manifesto, the Conservative Party gave a commitment to build 300,000 homes a year by the middle part of this decade. The current rates of build are not in line with that at the moment, and the majority of local authorities are behind with their local plan and struggling to find land to allocate for development. And this has led to a huge increase in the value of land that has development potential. Particularly in the south of England, we're seeing values as high as £1 million an acre.
Wow.
And even in the north, still in excess of £500,000 per acre. And a planning permission for residential development generally has the potential to increase the land by anything up to 50 times its agricultural value, so it's an absolutely huge increase.
So that's some real financial potential then.
Yes, I think I heard a colleague the other day describe it as the modern day gold rush for landowners.
Yeah. So, sounds it.
Definitely something that landowners are looking to cash in on. Particularly rural landowners who've got greenfield sites, those are particularly attractive for developers. Brownfield sites tend to come with much higher setup costs, potential land remediation, harder to put infrastructure in. So it's the agricultural land that really has the biggest value,
yeah.
Particularly if it's on the boundary of an existing settlement. Because in terms of access and infrastructure, it's much easier to put those services in than trying to do it in a site that's in the middle of nowhere.
That makes sense. Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay, so this is why landowners are looking at the agricultural tenancies.
Right. And many of them are being approached by developers and land promoters. It's not something they're actively having to go and look for necessarily. The market is supporting landowners in getting their sites allocated for planning and getting them through the planning process.
Yes.
And generally, a lot of developers and promoters will be happy to take on that planning risk for the landowners, so it comes with no cost to the landowner. Often they actually get a premium for signing up with a developer or promoter, so that's another incentive for them, in that although they then have to, you know, share the profit with the third party, the developer or the promoter, they don't have to take any of that initial risk on. So
yes,
it's a complete win for them.
They don't have certainty, don't they? They have the certainty that someone is going to drive it forward.
Absolutely. And someone who's got the expertise as
with
well.
With the expertise.
Yeah.
And actually at that point they don't have to incur the costs on
exactly.
on that process, which
exactly.
is, you know, that's a real...
They don't have to pay until the end of the process when the site's sold.
Yeah.
Then they just...
Interesting.
Walk away with a profit.
Okay. And of course, looking at the tenancy side of things, I understand there are two types of agricultural tenancy. So I believe there are agricultural holdings under the 1986 Act, and then we've got farm business tenancies under the 1995 Act. Rebecca, perhaps you wouldn't mind for our listeners talking about some of the key features of the 1986 Act tenancies.
Of course. The 1986 Act applies to an agreement of an agricultural holding which began before the 1st of September 1995. It may also apply in specified circumstances to a tenancy granted after that date. Now, there is no requirement for the agreement to be in writing. Therefore, the 1986 Act will also apply to oral tenancies. The whole of the land must be let for use as agricultural land. That is, land used for agriculture for the purposes of a trade or business. Now, the 1986 Act also carries succession rights, but only in relation to certain tenancies. So there are succession rights on death or retirement where the tenancies were granted before the 12th of July 1984. Those succession rights may also apply in relation to tenancy granted after that date. And there are certain specified circumstances where that may apply, including where, for example, the agreement between the parties indicates that those succession rights will be applicable.
Right, okay. So basically, if someone's sort of looking at dates of agreements and things like that, there may need to be a bit of, or there may be no written agreement, as you say, there may need to be a bit of homework done about what we've got.
It does, particularly where you're talking about very old tenancies.
Yes, yes, which often is the case.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. And then we've got these 1995 Act farm business tenancies. Emma, what are some of the key features of those?
Yeah, so farm business tenancies, they are tenancies of agricultural land entered into after the 1st of September 1995. In the same way as the 86 Act tenancies, they can be written or oral. In order to be a farm business tenancy, all or part of the land must be farmed for a trade or business, and the tenancy must be primarily agricultural in nature. The one key difference between farm business tenancies and the agricultural holdings tenancies is that there are no automatic succession rights under the 1995 Act. There's therefore no provision for a close relative to apply when the original tenant passes away.
Oh, okay. So the homework still needs to be done, but you may find yourself in a better position.
Yes.
with the farm business tenancies.
Yes, and generally, as we'll go on to, they are easier to terminate as a general rule.
Yes, which is going to be the thing that developers are going to be interested in once they've established what they've got. Rebecca, you mentioned the succession element with the 86 Act tenancies. I assume that may make them more difficult to terminate. Perhaps you would talk us through the process of regaining possession of land which is subject to that type of tenancy.
Generally, the 86 Act tenancies, the landlord still retains the common law right to determine the yearly tenancy by forfeiture, also by surrender at notice to quit. The 1986 Act, however, imposes restrictions on the landlord's right to terminate by notice to quit. And it does this in three important ways. First, the landlord must serve the notice to quit, which gives no less than 12 months' notice, subject to certain exceptions. Secondly, if an unqualified notice to quit is served, the tenant has power to give a counter notice, requiring the landlord to obtain consent from the tribunal. Now, the tribunal may grant consent on certain specific grounds. However, the tribunal must withhold that consent if it considers that in all the circumstances, no reasonable and fair landlord would insist on possession. And that is usually where the hurdle lies, and it's normally difficult for the landlord to overcome. The third restriction, which is placed on notices to quit, is where the notice to quit is served on the case grounds. There would be, with developer clients, seven grounds, cases A to G. And briefly, these are: case A is where there's compulsory retirement of a smallholder. Case B, land required for non-agricultural use, which we'll discuss in a moment. Case C, bad husbandry. Case D, non-payment of rent or non-compliance to remedy a remediable breach. Case E deals with an irremediable breach of the tenancy. Case F deals with insolvency. And case G deals with death of the tenant. And the landlord would need to be prepared to establish the facts for each case relied upon.
And that's interesting because, you know, when you think about sort of 54 Act tenancies and things like that, it's very similar really in a way, isn't it? There's sort of fault grounds and no fault grounds in a way.
Yes, that's correct, yes. Now, where the tenant can't serve a counter notice with the case notices to quit, and so the landlord doesn't need to obtain consent from the tribunal, the tenant does have a power to refer the matter to arbitration. may not apply to all of the cases, and it only applies to specific matters under those cases. But there is that further potential for delay. Mm-hmm. Also, assuming that the notice to quit is valid and it terminates the tenancy, it will still be necessary for the landlord to obtain a possession order from the court and thereafter to enforce it.
Yeah, so that could be quite some process. You've got the 12-month notice period, and then you've got potentially a process after that.
Yes. And the rights of succession also pose an obstacle. So, for example, if a tenant dies and an eligible person applies to succeed within 3 months of the death and is entitled to the grant of the new tenancy, it matters not that the landlord served a case G notice to quit.
Oh, wow. Okay. Goodness me. So there's a few hurdles there to think
of. Yes.
Yeah. Right.
And for developers, case B notice to quit, if it was served before the tenant died, and even though there had been a demand for arbitration but nothing has been determined, you'll find that it will not preclude succession rights being exercised.
So you'd start again?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So it's, if you're a developer looking at a notice, it's the case B notice that you procedure you'd be going under.
Yes.
And when you're serving those sorts of notices, can you, because obviously agricultural land can be quite big, can you serve it over, does it have to be over the whole or can it be part?
Yes, so this actually comes up quite a lot because you quite often, in the development context, you have a landowner who's got planning permission and it's only over part, so this question comes up a lot. Generally speaking, notices should be over the whole of the holding unless the tenancy agreement allows the landlord to terminate only part of the tenancy. In the development context as well, the 1986 Act does contain some exemptions to this general rule, which would then allow a landlord to terminate over part of the land to be developed. But it's only if the development is for very specific things. So, for example, making a road or a canal or a basin or gardens for farm worker cottages. They're really narrow and they don't come up all that often. Mm. I actually did have one that did come up. I served a case B notice over part of a holding that was to be made into a energy park, and then the actual part of the holding that I was dealing with was a road, and that is one of the exceptions within. So you do have to look at it quite carefully and obviously look into the planning permission and what is actually going to be happening on the land of your client if you are acting for the landlord. Mm. And then the only other alternative is a slightly complicated one, and it sort of remains to be completely confirmed whether this is an arrangement that would stand up. But the landlord can sever the freehold reversion into the holding so that the tenant essentially has two landlords, and this then allows your landlord to serve a notice over their part of the holding, which will then terminate essentially part of the tenant's tenancy. But yeah, like I said, there is some debate over that arrangement and whether it can be challenged on the basis that it's not necessarily a genuine severance of the holding.
Well, that sounds fun. Let's think about the 1995 Act. Tell me it's a bit easier. How do we terminate a farm business tenancy under that Act?
Easy peasy. Well, it's certainly easier, a lot easier than 86 Act tenancies. So the approach to termination depends on the length of the tenancy. So tenancies of 2 years or less will expire by a fraction of time, so you don't need a notice to quit at all.
Oh,
it will just come to an end on the term date, essentially.
Okay.
And then if the tenant did remain in possession and the landlord didn't want them to be in possession, then they would then have to commence proceedings for possession in the usual way. Tenancies in excess of 2 years must be terminated by a notice to quit on 12 months' notice. And then if the tenancy is for a period other than a year, such as a month, rolling month tenancy, then the period of notice is equal to the period of the term. So if it's a one-month tenancy, it's 1 month's notice.
Right.
So that is generally the statutory regime, so you don't have the sort of complicated case notices that you have in the 86 Act. You don't have to show that you fulfil those grounds. But the landlord does retain a right to forfeit the tenancy if the tenancy agreement allows for that option. So that's a common law right of forfeiture if the tenant is in breach.
If it's a breach, yes.
Yeah, so
yes.
It has to be a breach, obviously. And then the alternative is a surrender, which is when the parties both agree that the tenancy should come to an end on a specific date. It doesn't necessarily have to be the term date. It could be midway through the tenancy. But obviously the vital thing is that they must both be in agreement.
Yeah. And the key point for developers is that if you're dealing with a 95 Act tenancy, you don't have quite the same hurdles
exactly
as you would face with with the 86 Act. You've still got to do your homework and you've still got to, you know, serve the correct notice and give the right period of notice and all the rest of it, but not quite.
We see developers being much more comfortable with FBTs because there's a much clearer regime. You're not facing all the potential challenges that Rebecca talked about from a farm tenant or their, you know, nearest and dearest relations. It is a much more straightforward process.
Yeah, I can see why that would be more attractive.
Yes, and the thing about case B is there are just so many different steps that you have to go through procedurally, but also just trying to establish case B is difficult because you're having to show an intention for non-agricultural use. You need to have planning permission in place before you can serve the notice to quit, and your intention has to be present at the date of the service of the notice to quit, unlike with business tenancies.
Oh, interesting.
So it's very important to have everything in order before you serve your notice to quit.
Wow, that is quite a challenge, isn't it? Yeah. Gosh, so that really does require some serious thinking ahead.
It does.
Okay.
And so again, if you're a developer, if you have to have your planning in place before you can even think about terminating the tenancy, you have to take all the risk of going through the planning process, and then you still don't even have absolute certainty that the land will become free for the planning to be implemented.
No.
So it's a real headache.
Gosh, that is, isn't it? Yeah, I can see that is a real challenge. And we've mentioned about, obviously, if you can't terminate it that way, you know, particularly given the difficulties with the 86 Act tenancies, obviously then it is open to developers to look at trying to agree a surrender with the tenant and those sorts of things. And obviously if there's a breach situation, you know, try that route. I mean, does that tend to be the solution in your experience, Rebecca?
Well, it's an easier way of dealing with it.
Yes.
And there are obviously monetary benefits in doing so. I mean, there are various things that you could put forward to try and encourage a tenant to agree to a surrender. The real benefit is that the parties can operate outside the statutory restrictions on service notice to quit and agree to an earlier termination date. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, with lengthy termination dates, particularly if there's no provision in the tenancy agreement providing for earlier termination, that could scupper the development, especially if the developer, you know, has a particular time frame in mind. The other matter is that under the 1986 Act, the tenant would not be entitled to compensation for disturbance, that is the compensation for dispossession, because that right only arises on termination by notice to quit. However, that may be something which could be an incentive for the tenant by offering to pay the compensation for disturbance on surrender, notwithstanding the fact they wouldn't be statutorily entitled to it.
I mean, that must be a sensible course, wasn't it? You know, you, as a developer, you work out what the compensation would be, you work out what the cost would be on, you know, the delay, all these sorts of things, the legal costs of proving the case, and then hopefully you make a sensible offer and can agree something.
Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to say, sort of the timing of the negotiations, that's quite key as well, and when a landowner should try and, you know, contact the tenant. Essentially, what we see is if negotiations start once the permission has already been obtained, then the tenant may then try and hold the landlord to ransom and demand a premium for returning the holding to the landlord. That sometimes happens. And then, you know, the opposite, you've got a negotiation starting too early and the tenant may simply not engage on the basis that you actually don't think the landlord's genuinely going to see through their proposals or get the permission. So it's really quite an important factor, timing, and also quite key that landlords do obtain advice generally on their position overall so that we can try and assist with getting the best outcome for them, really.
Yes, that makes sense. Yes, time, I can see that. That's a tricky balance, isn't it? And from your side, James, obviously you're on the transactional side. Have you got any practical tips for our listeners about the documents that should be drafted, perhaps clauses that might be inserted to help a landowner's position if the land is subject to an agricultural tenancy?
Well, there's a few different options. As we've heard, the farm business tenancies are much easier to deal with. So if possible, one way of getting your agricultural tenant on side is to present it as, if they've got an Agricultural Holdings Act arrangement at the moment, to present it as, this is an opportunity to bring your tenancy up to date, we're prepared to grant you a new tenancy on these terms, perhaps offer them a financial incentive for doing that. But if you can shift them from the Agricultural Holdings Act that can be surrendered, and then you've got them a new replacement farm business tenancy, that would make dealing with the development side much more straightforward.
Yes, we've seen that, haven't we? We have seen
that. Particularly if you could get a break in that document
as well.
If you
can have early termination in your FBT, yeah, absolutely. And then if the parties are looking to go down the surrender route, one structure I have seen used is to have a conditional agreement for surrender. So the parties say that the agreement will fall away within 1 month of the planning permission being granted. That's potentially attractive for the tenant because it means they can continue in occupation of the premises for much longer. Obviously, there's the downside that their end date then is rather uncertain because they're completely dependent on the timing of the planning process, and that can make it difficult for them in running their business, planning crop cycles, things like that. But also for the landowner, it's an attractive route because it keeps the rental income going for as long as possible, rather than having to serve notice and then you sit with an empty site whilst you wait for the planning to come through.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? There's benefits for both sides. And presumably also that uncertainty element for the tenant can be catered for by, you could have a longer period of notice after which
you could have a longer period of notice, you can have a requirement to pay compensation.
Yes.
Sometimes developers are happy to foot the bill for that because it's the price you pay for certainty. So there's always a balancing act to be done between
the
financial cost of doing
income.
Something
yeah.
and the certainty of dealing with the site once you've got your planning consent in place.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I can see that. They've had the benefit, as you say,
exactly.
that cash flow as well
yes.
has come in. Yeah, that does make sense. Interesting.
And Emma mentioned the ransom point as well, that sometimes tenants, particularly well-advised tenants, will see that they're in potentially quite a strong position to upset a significant development deal, and will, you know, put a price on their agreement accordingly. So if there is a financial incentive given to the tenant, we would like to see something in the surrender documentation whereby the tenant agrees not to object to or frustrate the planning process, although there is still some uncertainty about whether those obligations are enforceable, because there's matters of public policy and things like that. You can't completely sort of silence people if they have legitimate objections.
But at least you've got a sort of principle
it's
agreed
some comfort,
and
some
comfort.
That,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, thank you all. That has been a fascinating run-through of agricultural tenancies. Lots of practical tips there as well as legal insights. Thank you very much to our listeners for your time as well, and we look forward to speaking to you at our next edition.
This is a Charles Russell Speechleys podcast.